This morning, we will be talking about adoption. According to a major national survey of attitudes about adoption that was done just a couple of years ago, about 4 in 10 Americans say that they have at least thought about adopting a child at some time in their lives. And that's a big number. That's more than 81 million adults. Only a small percentage, however, actually go on to adopt. So this morning in this part of the show, we'll talk a little bit about why it is that more people don't choose this way of having a family. I'll talk about the need and also the process. And our guest for the program is Adam Pertman. He is executive director of the Evan B. Donaldson Adoption Institute. That is a nonprofit group that does research and education around the issue of adoption. He's also the associate editor of Adoption Quarterly. That's the leading research journal that deals with adoption and foster care. He's author of the book Adoption Nation, How the Adoption Revolution is Transforming America. That came out a few years ago and is now still available. You can read the book. It's published by Basic Books and is available in paper. He is a former newspaper reporter. He worked for a number of years for the Boston Globe and, in fact, was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize for his writing about adoption in that paper. In addition, his commentaries on families and children have appeared in a number of other places, the L.A. Times, the Christian Science Monitor, the Boston Globe, the Baltimore Sun, the Miami Herald, and also on a national public radio, and he does a lot of interviewing on this subject, and he's joining us this morning by telephone, and we're pleased to have him as guest. Questions are welcome if you'd like to call in, questions, comments. The only thing we ask is just people try to keep their comments brief, and we do that so we can get in as many callers as possible. Anyone can call, of course, join the conversation here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, you're certainly welcome to call with your questions. Mr. Pertman, hello.
Hello. It's good to be here. Thank you.
Thank you very much for talking with us. We certainly do appreciate it. One of the things we know certainly is that there are many children who need homes. And according to the surveys, like the one that I cited, there are large numbers of Americans who would at least say that at some time they thought about adopting. Now, it wouldn't, and that's a lot of people, and I think we also know that it wouldn't take those 81 million people to do it to provide homes for the children that need it. It would only have to be a percentage of that. So I guess one of the things I'm wondering about is why it is that we have a lot of people who said, yeah, they'd thought about it, but why is it that the percentage of people who actually go on to do it is really rather small? What is it that seems to get in the way of people doing this?
Well, I think there are a lot of reasons. Somebody could write a book about it. but seriously, there really are a lot of reasons, and they differ by the individuals involved, just as the reasons that people have families biologically differ among different families. Obviously, the first reason is procreation and keeping the species alive. But that's not literally why most people form their families, right? I mean, they do it from everything from wondrous, wonderful reasons that are well thought out to, you know, a condom breaking. So people have a lot of different reasons for the way they form their families. I think in adoption in particular, the reasons have been more... But magnanimous, i.e., when you have a child biologically, you're really doing it for yourself. You want to be pregnant. You want to have children. It's all about the adults. And it has historically been and remains so more about, as you spell it out, about the kids, more front and center. That it's about certainly about your own wants and needs as an adult, but also wanting to genuinely give a home to a child who needs one. And that's a pretty basic difference between various those two forms of family formation, though, you know, in most ways they are identical in day-to-day life. The impediments, because there certainly have been impediments, are pretty wide-ranging. I'll list just a few and then we can continue the conversation. Mm-hmm. But they are everything from the stigma and shame that have been historically attached to adoption. Oh, I'm sorry, you couldn't have any real children. Well, that makes you feel real good and makes you want to run out and get a kid, doesn't it? You know, adopted kids are real children, and they need to be understood that way. And one of the wonderful things about what's happening in our world is we are understanding all of that and understanding that adoptive families can and should be on a level playing field. So it's everything from that to that biological urge to want to have kids who look like you, that is something to overcome. For the desire to be pregnant and procreate, that is something to be overcome. I'm not saying that's a negative thing. People need to keep doing those things. But for the sake of the kids who need homes, we also have to level the playing field and understand that there's no one norm. And so I think a lot of it is attitudinal. Some of it is legal. It has been tough to adopt children from foster care in past decades. That's getting much easier. And so many, many more people are doing it. And some of it, I think, is cultural. In most countries on Earth, in fact, don't adopt children in any real numbers from outside their biological families. It's just not considered something culturally that you do. Our country is different from that, and we adopt more children than the rest of the world combined. And so we have the climate, if you will, in which this kind of change can occur, and it is occurring, but all those lingering secrets, shame, stigma still exist.
Well, that's one of the things that I want to ask about, you know, not only how society feels about the parents, and you get that. I'm sure that people think, well, you know, that's really lovely. You have an opportunity to have this family this way, but, you know, as if it's somehow that second
right.
best.
Right.
And also, though, I wonder how it is we're thinking these days about what the experience is like for the adopted child. And, you know, there would have been a time when maybe people would have had all sorts of worries about how that was going to work out. And do you even, I suppose there might even be some people who would make the argument that if you adopted a child and that child young enough that they didn't know, that you should never even tell them that they were adopted. And then, of course, you get into even more complicated sorts of conversations about what do you tell them about their biological parents?
Sure.
Should there be some opportunity, should they choose to have contact with, and then it gets even way more complicated. But just sticking with the issue of what the experience is like for the adopted child.
Right.
Are there still people who have sort of concerns about the whole concept and whether that's good for that child or not?
Well, I think that part is dissipating some, though I think people still don't understand the adoption experience perfectly well. There is still an extent to which, when I talk about leveling playing field, I'm not saying that all families are identical. You know, single-parent families are not the same as step families, are not the same as divorce families, are not the same as families with one, you know, black parent, one white parent, are not the same as families with one Christian parent, one Jewish parent. Families are different, and adoptive families are different, and the experience of the people in them are as well. So we too often still try to fit the square peg in the round hole and say, well, are adoptees exactly the same as their peers? No. And children in all those other families aren't exactly the same either. The question is, are they doing well? Is this a good experience for them? Are they better off than they would have been in some other, you know, in an institution or wherever else they might have been? And the answer to all those questions are yes. These families, our families, because I'm an adoptive dad, our families are on a level playing field in every emotional and social way, or should be, but they're not as well understood. And all those decades when we barely whispered the word adoption, where very often we didn't even tell our own kids they were adopted, and no, that is not good practice. lying to your own kids is probably not the best idea. It deprives them of everything from their own identity to their own medical history, and on and on. But this is something, and it's worth saying, that we didn't do really well for decades and decades for anybody involved. I mean, this is, I think most people now would agree, you know, adoption is a good thing for kids who need homes, for the people involved, but it's not an uncomplicated thing. And for generations, we pretended it was. We treated birth parents, the people who create our children, as though they were invisible or they should go away. We felt bad for the adoptive parents, oh, I'm sorry, you couldn't have any real children, as though they're doing something second rate. And we called those kids, keep in mind, and we still do sometimes, illegitimate and bastards. Hmm. Nice, huh? Good way to think about children. And so, you know, it can be such a positive institution. But one of the wonders, I talk about the adoption revolution in the title of my book and in the book. Well, one of the wonderful, good, positive things that's happening is we're treating everybody in this process with real respect, with greater respect. And one of the things, the primary things that we do at the Donaldson Adoption Institute is try to make that playing field more level, so everyone is, in fact, treated thoughtfully, humanely, and, you know, helping create that level playing field.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Adam Pertman. He's executive director of the Evan Donaldson Adoption Institute in New York. He has written about this in his book, Adoption Nation, How the Adoption Revolution is Transforming America. Before taking up his present job, he was a reporter. He worked for the Boston Globe, wrote about a number of different things, including adoption, and was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize for his writing about adoption in the Globe. Questions are certainly welcome. Questions, comments, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. It seems among people who are interested in adopting, there seems to be an overwhelming desire for people to adopt infants, and I expect that's because people believe that the ultimate outcome will be better the younger the child is. Is there any reason to believe or data that shows that somehow that adopted children will be healthier, happier, better adjusted, that everything will be better if they are the younger they are at the time that they are adopted?
Well, the general answer to your question is yes, but it's really not because of adoption per se. In other words, people wonder, well, do adopted kids have more problems, fewer problems, whatever. You know, there are a lot of questions that float like that, and we do research and policy work around those questions. But what we often miss, and I will answer your question directly, what we often miss is it's not the adoption that's the issue or the reason why the answer to your question is generally yes. It's what happened before the adoption. So in other words, if you're in an orphanage for 7 years and then you're adopted, are you likely to have more developmental and other issues than someone who was not in an orphanage for 7 years? Of course. If you are in foster care, and kids who are in foster care are there because of abuse and neglect, right? So if you've been in foster care for 3, 4, 5 years, which too often happens, and you've gone from one home to the next and you're not forming good attachments, you're not getting the care that you need, well, by the time you're adopted at the age of 6, do you think that you might have more issues than if you were adopted or stayed in your birth family, but were, you know, in a secure, loving, safe home from the age of 0 or 1 or 2? Of course. So the older the kids get, the more issues they face within their new families, which can be adoptive families. And so that reality is there in front of us. Now, the good news, and it is very good news, is that Americans are learning that it's okay, and we are adopting as a people more of those older kids than we historically ever have, probably than any people have on the face of the earth, which is quite wonderful for those children. And for, you know, to make it up, the 45-year-old who's deciding to have a kid for the first time and has a job, getting a 7-year-old who's already in school and doesn't need their diapers changed can seem a pretty attractive proposition. So there's a confluence of factors here that is helping people get past this question of, well, will this baby be perfectly healthy? Because let's face it, if your baby is not perfectly healthy, you don't, you know, try to put it back in. You raise the kid you get, and some of them have issues, some don't have issues. They all do better once they are in loving, safe, permanent families, and that's the realization we're coming to. And it is part of this revolution, in fact, because for the first time, certainly in American history and probably human history, people who are fertile, who can make babies, are choosing to adopt children instead. That's a very new paradigm in social history, and obviously very, very good for the kids who need homes. Mm.
You know, I think that some of the people who would say we had been thinking about adoption, we considered it, we looked into it, some of the people would say maybe the reason that they didn't do it was that they, when they realized what it would cost,
right,
they said, you know, this is we had no idea, right, that it would cost this much money, and for us, simply, that's just not an option. Talk about costs.
Well, I think that Chapter 8 of my book is called the Money's the Problem. I think money causes a lot of problems in my particular field, as it does in others. But when you're talking about children, when you're talking about child welfare, putting dollar signs in the equation really is more complicating than if you're talking about, you know, the interstate transfer of snow tires. I would argue it's not as healthy, but it is our reality. We live in a free enterprise system in which we do relegate kids too often to to the same realm as those notars. And the consequence is what you see. We pay for legal services, we pay for medical services, we pay for all the services that in other countries are covered by the state because it's considered child welfare and not a part of free enterprise. And so we wind up paying a lot of money. For example, right now, to adopt a child, not an infant, but a young child from another country or an infant in this country, you could pay anywhere from $25,000 to $40,000 in fees. Now, the good news is that there are some tax credits, and this is probably money pretty well spent. But the other, I guess, bigger good news is that if you adopt from foster care, because you can do that as well, there are no costs. In fact, sometimes there are subsidies. But the money is an issue. The money is an issue. You know, I don't judge at all how people want to form their families, whether it's the 83rd in vitro fertilization or adopting abroad or adopting domestically or choosing not to have children. What I think we do need to do is educate ourselves better about what the processes entail, which one works and which one doesn't best for us as individuals, you know, younger child, older child, abroad, domestic, foster care. And that's where I think we as a culture and where all the secrecy that surrounded adoption for decades really have failed us. And going back to your very first question of the interview, where it has undermined the prospects for children to get homes. Educated people make better decisions. And the secrecy and the shame and the stigmas and all that that surrounded all sorts of adoptions, adoption per se, for generations, was not a conducive climate for helping us educate ourselves. So I think for all those kids and for all those families, I think we're getting to be in a better place.
Well, we have one caller here we want to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. Someone who is listening in Urbana, and this is line one. Hello.
Hi there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I just thought I would call in because I'm an adoptive parent, and I get lots of uneducated comments from people. I won't use that IG word, but that's what it is. Anyway, there's just a couple of little points that I wanted to bring up, and they're just kind of sayings that help me with things. One is that when people are trying to talk about what's it like to have an adoptive parent kid and, you know, well, aren't you worried about this and that? And one thing I tell the other parents is that nobody chooses their children. You know, I didn't go to the store and pick out this one off the shelf. You know, whether you have birth children or adoptive children, you don't know what they're going to turn out to be. You know, my parents may not have wanted to have, may not have chosen me as the person that they would thought would be their daughter because I'm fairly non-traditional, and maybe my mom wanted a sweet little girl that was dresses and pin curls. That wasn't me. She didn't choose that. And the same thing with an adopted kid. You don't know. You know, you may think, that, oh, I've got the perfect adoptive kid. But they're different than what you expect. Life is different. Kids are different. Kids grow up to be different than what your ideal plan is. And it doesn't really matter whether they're adopted or biological. And the other thing that I tell my kids is nobody got to choose their parents. You know, my teen years were fraught with tension with my parents, and I might have thought, oh, I wish that wasn't my mom and dad. And, you know, my adopted kids, and this is something that you learn in the classes you take, is that at some point those kids are going to say, I don't have to do what you say. You aren't my real mom anyway. And the first time it came out of my kid's mouth, I just burst out laughing. Check that off on the developmental list, just like first tooth, because they're all going to say it. But the answer is nobody chooses their parents. Nobody picks their parents out of the lineup and says, this is what I want as a parent. So there are lots of challenges, and there are lots of wonderful, wonderful experiences with adoption and with parenthood in general. But nobody picks their kid, and nobody picks their parent. Anyway, that's all I've got to say.
All right. Well, thanks for the thoughts. And you can, Mr. Burton, you can comment on that any way you like.
Well, it's certainly true. I've had already the experience that your caller described. It's funny. One of the challenges and fears that adoptive parents and pre-adoptive parents, and again going back to your initial question, yet another reason why some people decide not to adopt is they're afraid of the birth parents. They're afraid, will this child ever really be mine? Will he want to go back to his birth mother when he's 13 and says, I'm not his real mother? And all those sorts of questions that are born of somewhat of the IG word that your caller discussed, meaning ignorance. But I don't use that pejoratively. A lack of information can be ignorance, too. And insecurity. I mean, we adoptive parents can be, as many people can be, insecure because, you know, we generally speaking try to make a baby, couldn't do it, wonder if we're ever going to have children, are these kids going to be loyal to us, all those myths and stereotypes that have floated around about adoption. So we wonder, at 13, is this kid going to say she hates me and is going back to real parents because she, or what she calls her real parents, because, you know, she's going through an identity crisis and wonders about all this. Let me tell you, at 13, they don't want any parents. And kids use whatever ammunition they've got. Now, so they're going to use that. If you're divorced, they'll use that. If you're single, they'll use that. If you're tall, they'll use that. And if they're short, you're short, they'll use that because they'll use whatever they can as they form their identities. Now, that said, this is a good example of where, in fact, there are differences. And differences are not better or worse. They're just differences. Developmentally, it's appropriate and normative for a kid, say at 9, 10, boys maybe 11, to start understanding that if they're in this new family, they lost an old family. That's reasonable. So grief may kick in. Identity issues may kick in. A desire, if they don't already have it, to have a relationship or at least some knowledge about the person who created them kicks in. That's all okay. Because if we get past our myths, our stereotypes, and our insecurities, we know from both research and experience that that kind of relationship, that kind of knowledge is absolutely not only fine for the kid growing up, but for you as a parent, so you have better information with which to raise your child, and certainly more respectful and better for the birth parents who don't really, despite the myths and stereotypes, we also did a study on this, don't really forget about the lives they created. They wonder about them and want to know about them for the rest of their lives.
We're about midway through this part of Focus 580. We're talking this morning about adoption. And our guest is Adam Pertman. He is the executive director of the Evan B. Donaldson Adoption Institute in New York. That's a national nonprofit group that does research and education around the issue of adoption. He's the associate editor of Adoption Quarterly. That's a research journal that deals with adoption and foster care. He is the author of the book Adoption Nation, How the Adoption Revolution is Transforming America. It's published by Basic Books. It's available in paperback. He spent more than two decades as a journalist at the Boston Globe. Wrote about a number of subjects, including this one, and he was actually nominated for a Pulitzer Prize for his writing about adoption. His commentaries on families and children have appeared in many places, papers around the country, including the LA Times, Christian Science Monitor, the Boston Globe, Baltimore Sun, Miami Herald, and he's also been widely interviewed on the subject. And questions and comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I'm just curious about whether your interest in writing on this subject, did that grow out of your experience as an adoptive parent, or maybe was that the other way around?
Yeah, good question. The answer is sort of to the former. I was a journalist, and journalists want to write about things that people care about that affect a lot of people. And then my wife and I adopted our son, Zach, and I was not one of those, and there are many, passionate new dads who said, I have to do this for my child, for my son. I want to change my life. I did that later, but I didn't do it then. Then I did what most journalists do. You know, if they get a speeding ticket on the highway, they want to write about the radar gun. And so in that sense, fairly dispassionately, I saw a process that I thought people didn't understand very well. I saw an effect on human beings that I thought had not been written about extensively enough. And so, you know, it was another journalistic exercise for me, and that was the series I did for the Globe that was nominated for the Pulitzer. But the reaction to it was off the charts, like nothing I had ever done before. And I'd covered the fall of the Berlin Wall, presidential campaigns, O.J. Simpson trial, on and on. And nothing ever elicited the kind of reaction that this did. And that led me to write my book, because every journalist wants to write a book. And it was during the writing of my book that I realized this is not just a journalistic exercise. This is important. This is for those kids and all their various parents And I would say accurately that that changed my life.
Well, something that I want to spend some time talking about is what's going on with international adoption. Again, I guess it's my understanding that, you know, because so many couples who are interested in adopting children really would like to have an infant, that has helped to, over the last, I don't know, a couple of decades maybe, really create this international market. Maybe that's the right word or the wrong word, I don't know, an opportunity to adopt.
An accurate description, anyway.
I expect that probably is. The opportunity to adopt a child from another country. And though recently, I think, for a variety of reasons, the complications introduced into the process by the government of the United States is one. And I think, in fact, also there are some places that, some countries that had started to turn around their policy and perhaps put restrictions on or try to limit the number of children that were adopted outside of that country. What's going on with international adoptions today?
It's a good question. It's probably the most provocative and active area of active, not in numbers, because numbers are going down, but in terms of legislative and policy decisions in the adoption world right now. Let me give, if I can, I'm just going to give a minute a quick background for this. For the last 15 years or so, adoption from overseas has boomed. And that was mainly because of historic events that most people don't perceive as adoption-related, China's imposition of one-child policy, the fall of the Berlin Wall. You know, these were political events that were that occurred for reasons absolutely outside the adoption world, but had a powerful impact on the adoption world and on families in the United States because, you know, a lot of Chinese girls have been abandoned and adopted by Americans. And the orphanages in Eastern Europe, we discovered when the wall fell that they were teeming with children who needed homes. So it really changed our world and changed, it's part of this revolution and changed our culture. And, you know, you see it all around you with, you know, white parents with children of color who are celebrating, you know, Chinese New Year at their synagogue. It really is having a profound, all these things are having a profound effect, and the numbers started rising as a result of availability as well as what you say, rightly called demand. People were ready for this, and there are other sociological trends, people getting older, infertility rates. I think what you see now with Barack Obama as a candidate started happening and, in fact, was aided and abetted by adoption because attitudes started changing, what families looked like started changing, acceptance of transracial, biracial families. We've made some progress in this regard, and adoption is one of the reasons. Against that backdrop, there were a lot of, or as a causal a product, there were a lot of kids available, and there were a lot of people who were ready to give those kids homes, and the numbers started skyrocketing for about 15 years. What has happened very recently, just in the last year or so, is a confluence of some related and some unrelated factors. I'll give you just some quick examples. Stories about abuse in the Guatemalan child welfare and adoption system caused that country to cut off adoptions while they, quote, clean up their act, or what the United States sees as they're cleaning up their act. China decided maybe it's Olympic-related, maybe it's because they have fewer children, girls, who they are ready to place for adoption. Whatever the reasons, China this year imposed quite strict restrictions on who can adopt their children, weight restrictions, what drugs you have taken, your marital status, you have to be married. So China did that. At the same time, Korea, which has long been a big, what we call, sending country of adopted kids, of kids for adoption, has started to nurture more of a domestic, within Korea, adoption, changing attitudes there. So more Koreans are willing to adopt kids from within their culture, and that cuts down on the numbers going abroad, and on and on. So some reasons are related, some are unrelated, and meanwhile, something called the Hague Convention on Intercountry Adoption is now in force in the United States, as it is in many countries around the world, and that, for the first time, imposes a legal structure and process structure on international adoption for the first time. And that has restrictions and regulations and monitoring and on that we've never had in international adoption. And not everybody is conforming so quickly, and some of it is complicated. And that's also, at the same time, resulting in some diminution or constriction in international adoption. And so what we see is we have been roughly at 20,000 adoptions from overseas a year for the last few years, and that is certainly going to drop to somewhere between 10 and 15 in the coming year is a good guess. So that was a long snapshot.
Well, that you would wonder whether that might actually, if you're interested in trying to persuade people to adopt children who are available in the United States, maybe children who are a little bit older, you wonder would that maybe actually work to the good of American children who are also looking for homes, who maybe might be passed over by people who were saying, well, you know, I really would like to have that infant. If that gets more difficult or if it's just not possible, maybe more people would be willing to think about adopting a little bit older child here in the United States.
Well, I think that is happening. I think we'll see it more in the next year or so. And it was happening partly because of what was happening abroad as well, and that is that those kids, because of processes within the sending countries, those kids have been starting to get, been ticking upwards in age in the last few years as well. So people, even people who started the process thinking they were going to get an infant from country X, very often either wound up with an older child or, and this is another phenomenon that we saw occurring, wound up with a sibling group. So, yes, they might have gotten, I'm making it up, but a 10-month-old, but they also got her three-year-old sister. So, because you don't want to split up the siblings, and people fall in love, and they surely do. So people, I think, in the going abroad have, over the course of time, been readjusting their thinking to older children already. So that jump to the older kid in the foster from the foster care system, I don't think for many people will not be as big as it could have been if they thought for sure they're getting an infant.
You know, you're talking a little bit earlier about these interesting kind of culturally blended families that you get, and when you have people who adopt children that are maybe from different cultural backgrounds or different ethnic backgrounds, and that can be both a challenge and I'm sure a pleasure for parents to explore with their children that background and in a sense have everybody learning about that. That there also, I'm sure, may still be some controversy, particularly I think in the past was controversy, about the idea of transracial or transcultural adoption and whether that was a good thing or not a good thing. And questions were raised about whether a parent from one cultural or ethnic background could really raise a child from a different one and make sure that child did in fact connect with the place or the tradition or the culture or the ethnicity or whatever it was that that child had come from. Is that still in a lot of people's minds? Is that still a big issue?
Well, it's still an issue. What it isn't too often is a roadblock. People certainly think about this, and one of the implementing regulations of the Hague Treaty dictates that parents who adopt from abroad need to have to get 10 hours of training relative to issues like race, ethnicity, differences with their kids, because this is actually a great illustration of some of the radical changes that have occurred in adoption over time. People used to adopt kids who were of different race or ethnicity, and literally were told by their social workers who thought it was good practice at the time, well, you just raise this child as though she was born to you. You know, the square peg in the round hole. Well, that sounds good. It feels good to that parent who wants to have a family just like every other. But, you know, you're white and that kid is Korean. It's not exactly the same. And her experience on the school bus coming home is not the experience you had. And understanding that in a nutshell, because that goes across a lot of issues, understanding that is a positive thing for a parent to know in raising his or her kid. You know, understand your children and their experiences, and you'll do a better job as a parent. And so we have come in the field to understand that keeping kids figuratively and literally comfortable in their own skin is a good thing. And so not only does that mean that you train and you understand, learn about your child in a way that we didn't think about before or didn't do before, but it means you perceive yourself differently too. You are not, you know, a white parent with a African-American child or an Asian child. You're a multiracial family. And that's, those are two different ways of thinking about the same thing. And we are getting better. We ain't there yet, but we are getting better at doing that. And so none of it, not none of it, there's still people who raise the questions about transracial adoption. I'm not one of them, and the Institute is not one of them. But the conversation really has shifted not to whether you can have these families. The reality is we do every single day of the week. But how do we help these families succeed, and how do we help the kids within those families succeed?
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. We have a couple of callers we'll get right to. Also, for anyone who's just tuned in, I'd like to introduce again our guest, Adam Pertman. He's the executive director of the Evan Donaldson Adoption Institute in New York. It's a national nonprofit that is interested in doing research and education around the issue of adoption. And if you're interested in finding out more about adoption or about the institute, you can go to their website, which is www.adoptioninstitute.org. Let's talk with some more folks here. I have somebody on a cell phone, line one. Hello.
Hello. Yeah. I was hoping the guest could address same-sex adoptions if he hasn't already talked about it, and basically just kind of cover some of the difficulties that a same-sex couple in the U.S. might experience.
Sure.
As opposed to, you know, in another country, and whether it makes a difference if you're adopting kids from this country or another. Thanks. I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Thank you for the question.
Sure. Happy to. And, in fact, we've not only done research on this and issued reports on it, but we're in the middle of a very big project following up. And by the way, whenever we do something like this, we deal with an issue like gay lesbian adoption or foster care adoption, where people assume, oh, so that's what you do. And just so people know, we do research, policy development, and education around the whole gamut of issues relating to adoption. So, for example, there is gay and lesbian adoption in America. It's more prevalent than most people realize. And so initially we just wanted to get some baselines. How often is it happening? What agencies, if any, are, you know, doing this overtly or covertly? What are best practices if you're going to do this? What serves children's interests best? And so now to get to a short answer, what we, in our last report, which was a couple years ago, and we have a new one coming out in just a few months, what we looked at the literature, we did the work involved, and found that there was no reason for gays and lesbians not to be parents, not to adopt. So that argument is getting settled in reality in most places every day because a growing number of gays and lesbians are adopting kids from foster care and in other ways, and it's going well. So, you know, in practice on the ground, the reality is progressing, though not in every state. Florida, for example, overtly is the only state that by statute overtly bans adoption by gays and lesbians. And some other states raise impediments to gays and lesbians becoming adoptive parents and foster parents in some states, but not in most states. And in most states, you see this progression. The answer to is it easier in some realms than others? Absolutely. I'm not sure there are any countries other than the U.S. that explicitly permit someone gay or lesbian to adopt a child from that country. We do in this country, and again, it's happening in growing numbers from foster care around the country, and they seem to be quite successful homes. And in fact, the foster care workers on the ground, I think, will tell you in most places that they see this as a population that is very amenable to the kids they have and is giving homes to them.
All right. Hope that gets to the question of the call. Let's go on to line number two. This is someone in Urbana. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. We drive some back roads through a particular part of the country pretty frequently, and I see a lot of anti-abortion ads, and some of which promote adoption. But they never seem to be promoting how to adopt, just how reasons not to have abortions. And it's always struck me that I like your focus, which is on the welfare of the child. When I've talked with some people who say, there's no babies around, we can't get any babies, I say, how come the United Way has agencies that promote adoption and list how many children are available just in Illinois. And older kids need families just as much as an infant does, if not more. I'm also wondering what we could do to promote fostering, as it's a different psychology, and some fostering leads to adoption, but not always. So I don't know what the details are on that, but it seems that we also need, from what I've gathered, more and good foster parents. And I'm wondering, too, you're mentioning about the finances being a real issue. I'd like to send a challenge out there to groups, especially churches, and especially ones that are anti-abortion, that they find ways to help fund the costs of adoption or the costs of that aren't covered by other things for children who are fostered within their congregations. Just some thoughts. One more. I'm at it. I'd also like to see those who want large families, that they consider having some of their own and not having all of them their own, since there's so many kids around who need a loving family. If you're a person who really, really loves kids and really wants to have lots of kids, wouldn't it be great if more of those folks who have that ability could adopt or foster kids? I realize it's a big challenge. It's nothing is blanket. I like your point of view about what works for different people. Thanks so much. It's really been interesting listening to you.
Thank you. A couple quick comments, because mm-hmm. there was a whole lot there.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's clearly a trend, and a good one, that there's more and more focus on getting those older kids into homes, and that's really a wonderful thing. We absolutely need more people to step up to bat to be foster and adoptive parents. As the stigmas, as the shame, as the stereotypes start to fade and we understand that our families are just as whole and just as real and just as loving, and by the way, and that our kids are our own. We haven't even figured out the vernacular for all this, right? Whose kids are they once you adopt them? They're yours. So we can fill out our families either, you know, from scratch or add to them with these groups of kids. But we do have to sort of change our mindset. It's not all about blood. It's not all about having a kid who looks just like you. It's about, in the construction that I hope we can get to, and we are getting to, it's for you too. You'll love being a parent. But it's mainly about providing a home for a human being who really needs one.
I think it's really interesting, and you did actually touch on this earlier, that you felt that this perhaps might be small, but that there were growing numbers of people who were fertile and who could have biological children, should they chose to, that were interested in and were adopting. And I think that I expect that in the past, maybe the main reason that people adopted was that they weren't fertile and that they could not have
That's
biological
right.
children. And I think it's really interesting that, in fact, that there might be some a significant, maybe small, but significant number of people who would say, no, we're going to make a conscious choice. We could have a child the old-fashioned way, but we're going to make a conscious choice to adopt a child and to bring a child into our family that way.
And I think symbolically and in real terms, that's the revolution, and that's really, really different and speaks volumes about the possibilities for these kids.
Lee had to talk with somebody else here in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
I just had a comment to make about, I adopted a child who's now finished her sophomore year in college, and she wanted to meet her birth parents when she turned 18, which I was perfectly fine with. But since she's met her birth parents, there have been some issues, just, you know, the pressure from the birth family. So I just wanted to mention that as a point. I mean, you're talking about adopting children and raising them, and they're yours. But then in some cases, the birth parents do want to stay in touch after the child is an adult, and you still have to be there to counsel them through those stresses.
Absolutely. You never stop being a parent just because my mother, the best line in my book is from my mother, not from me. Once I called her up to say I was going to be a dad, we got the call saying we're going to adopt Zach. And my mom said, all right, Now you can worry for the rest of your life. And, you know, you never stop being a parent.
Yeah.
And, by the way, that's true for those many of those birth parents who did not get to raise their kids, but never stop thinking about them. That doesn't mean they're perfect people any more than we are.
Right.
But
right.
realizing that you're, if it's all about the kid, and that would be nice, wouldn't it? They sometimes have a need to know, and I think that we as a culture and as human beings, where do we get off saying you have no right to know?
Oh, no, I perfectly...
No, I know you're not saying that. I'm just saying generically we too often go there.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean it'll be a perfect situation by any stretch. No,
well,
marriages aren't either.
Yeah, but all I could do for my daughter was just sort of be a safety net for her.
Right, exactly.
Watching her go through that, she had to process all of this. She kept saying, well, I already have a family, so why does she want me to be her daughter again? You know, it's just it was a bit of a trauma, and she's still working her way through it, but I just wanted to... say she's 20, and, you know, I'm still helping her with all this. So
the good news is that her real mom, you, were there for her.
Yeah, that was a real gratifying. Well, it's kind of hard to say. I mean, I'm glad I was there for her, but I had to educate myself on this. I really did, and I was sort of prepared for it. As one of the other callers said, you just have to be ready and waiting when those questions and problems, you know, crop up. But it was painful to see her go through it. So anyway, I'll hang up. And it was a good show. Thank you.
All right, well, thank you. Well, this I think that this points to one of the other big changes that's happened, and that is that there would have been a time when the... this reunion would not have occurred. That is when adoptions were closed, and it didn't matter whether you wanted to or not. You know, you'd never know who your biological parents were, and there was no opportunity for contact for anybody. And that everything was closed, ironclad, door shut. That's it. Forget it. And that one of the big changes is that now it is possible for people to look for their children, for children to look for their parents, and
it happens every single day, because we live in a climate where they can do what they think is right and what they feel is right for themselves and not what the culture imposed on them. Unfortunately, and again, this gets back to the work we do at the Institute, unfortunately, not all law and practice has kept up with that reality, that changed reality on the ground. And so there are real impediments, legal impediments, to these human beings, adults, I'm talking about adult adoptees, doing what they want, which sometimes, not always, is trying to find out who created them.
Well, what's the argument there for that, for making that an option?
It's for making an option or having an impediment to it?
Well, I guess maybe both. I guess, though, I'm thinking more, what's the argument for actually making it open, for making that an option?
Sure. I mean, first let me just say that no one option works for everybody. This should be the choice of the people involved. But too often, they don't have a choice. So I'll use a really concrete, extreme example to make the case, because life is generally more gray. But an adopted person growing up has some identity questions, has some medical questions, has some genuine reason to want to know. Now, in most cases, they just want to know. And we know that we see that in the research and in practice. But they have a genuine need to know. Well, if you're an adopted person in most of this country, it means you have to go to court and convince a judge. You're 32 years old, and you have to convince a judge that it's okay, I should be allowed to see my original birth certificate because I want information from there with which to find my birth mother because I need a match for a transplant. That's insulting. You and I have our original birth certificates by virtue of being born, and it's a matter of course, and it is not a level playing field for that that human being to have to go to court, pay costs, pay search fees, etc., in order to be in the same place as you and I are as a birthright, unless one thinks that they're going to do something bad with that information. You know, if they're going to be a stalker, if they're going to do something, disrupt someone's life, there is no evidence to indicate that that's true. And therefore, why have laws that impede something that not everyone, but that some people want and that benefits them?
We're just at the point here where we're going to have to finish. I guess one of the things that I know, one of the things your organization is interested in doing is putting out information about adoption and perhaps getting at those things, those kind of major misconceptions, the things maybe that people think are true that aren't, or address those concerns. Are there still, do you think, major ways in which you would say people misunderstand adoption?
I think there are. I don't think they're malicious. I don't think they're badly intended. I just think, you know, some of the myths and stereotypes feed. I'll give you a quick example. One of the reasons people are concerned that about giving adult adoptees their birth certificates in case they might search for their birth mothers is, oh, my God, that woman was promised lifelong anonymity and her life will be ruined. Well, that's a common myth. And it underlies a lot of the laws and practices that still occur in most states. Well, we've done the research, other people have as well, and we all come to the same conclusion. They were never promised any such thing. And overwhelmingly, and I do mean overwhelmingly, they want to know what happened to the lives they created. They welcome the contact. Not that they want a relationship, not that they want to be mommy. They know that's gone. This your kid is now 32. He knows who mommy is. She raised him. But they want to, like every woman alive, I think, want to know what happened to the life they created. That's normal. And so, but we have, because we have some pretty basic mistaken notions, it affects policy and practice in ways that can undermine the people involved, and including adoptive parents like me. And that's not healthy for anybody. So our mission is to level that playing field through better information, through greater knowledge.
Well, if you're interested in information and knowledge about adoption, you can go to the website of the Evan B. Donaldson Adoption Institute. It's in New York, and the site is adoptioninstitute.org. Our guest this morning, Adam Pertman, he is the executive director. You also might want to look at his book, Adoption Nation, How the Adoption Revolution is Transforming America. Mr. Pertman, thanks very much.
It's my pleasure.